Discover Cambon Podcasts, conversations and audio documentaries imagined by Chanel that explore what inspires fashion, literature, cinema, dance, and savoir-faire. This series of rendezvous gathers artists and friends of the house. Listen to Cambon Podcasts at Chanel.com and on the streaming platforms.
Happy Saturday. It's August 23rd, 2025, and you are listening to Morning Meeting. I'm Ashley Baker, back here in gray and chilly London.
I'm Michael Haney, back here in, you know, increasingly fall-like New York City.
But we are two of your airmail editors who are here to cherish this last week of summer. We've got a great episode and issue to get through today. But first, the news. In France, President Macron has had enough. He has filed a lawsuit against the American hard-right influencer Candace Owens. She has continued to peddle a five-year-old conspiracy theory that Brigitte Macron, his wife, was born as a man and later changed gender. The French president says that this all boils down to the fact that he has to, quote, defend his honor. Rightly done, sir. Meanwhile, in the UK, on September 1st, Eli Lilly, which manufactures the popular weight loss drug Mounjaro, has said that its price is going to nearly triple here in the UK. This is yet again thanks to Trump, who noticed that it was remarkably less expensive over here and complained about, quote, foreign freeloaders who rely on the US to pay more for medicine. Needless to say, in the most stylish circles in London, this is cause for catastrophe. As always, airmail is the antidote to all of these unfortunate realities.
Yeah, we've got a great show, as you mentioned. First, if you've been following Donald Trump's targeting of American universities, you know he's brought an especially intense focus to Ivy League schools, such as Harvard, Penn, Brown, and Columbia. Yet one of the Ivies, Yale, has so far escaped much of his wrath. And our colleague, Claire Malot, is going to join us with her report on why this is. Then, as everyone enjoys these last days of summer, you'd think people would be in a mellow mood. Well, no. Not if you have a house in Nantucket, the splendid and isolated island off of Cape Cod in Massachusetts, where summer is more than just a time for the 75 billionaires and counting who come to visit their second homes. It's also when the picture-perfect island's cracks begin to show. And our writer, Bill Cohen, is going to join us from Nantucket with all the dirt and drama. And finally, it might seem like the world these days is full of nothing but cranks looking for an argument, but Hayley Pepin is going to join us from London with some nice news, specifically the return of conversation pits in home design. So grab a spot on the couch because she's going to tell us all about it. Ashley, where would you like to begin today?
Michael, as much as I would love to avoid all these dyspeptic people and just start with interior design and home decor, we can't do that. We have to get to the news first, which means Claire Malot, who is our investigations editor here at Airmail, is going to tell us all about what's happening and not happening at Yale University. Welcome, Clara.
Thank you.
So, Clara, we know that Trump's grudges are a major motivating factor when it comes to selecting which universities he and his government intend to go after. But as you report in your story this week, there's also a sort of different metric, a woke-o-meter, if we can call it that. Let's start there.
Yeah, so Trump uses this organization's rankings, it's called FIRE, as part of his choice of which schools to ding and try to, you know, threaten these cuts of federal funding. And interestingly, Yale and Dartmouth are the outliers of the Ivies. They're the only two schools that have been moving up the rankings, and they're still getting like C-plus rankings, but they are moving in the direction that the Trump administration likes in just in terms of free speech. And so it seems like that's part of the reason they've been somewhat protected.
Tell us a little bit about this organization and FIRE and exactly kind of what it's looking at and how it's coming up with these rankings per se. I mean, it all seems so arbitrary, but it turns out there's actual criteria that they're using to assess.
Yeah, so it's not just about controversies on campus, but it's actually about how the universities respond to those controversies. So for instance, if there is a speaker coming to campus, let's say it's a conservative speaker, and there is this outcry from students trying to cancel that speaker. Let's say Ben Carson's coming to campus and liberal students are trying to protest, cancel that speaker. That would be a ding against the school. But if the administration responds and kind of strictly protects the speaker, make sure that the liberal students understand that, you know, free speech is an important characteristic of the university experience, then they actually get a positive grade, let's say, in that circumstance. So they're getting ranked both on the controversies and how the school responds. And there are other metrics, you know, other things they look at too, like, for instance, how many conservative versus liberal speakers the school has to make sure that they have both. And do students feel comfortable speaking out, you know, speaking about their genuine opinions, both in terms of with the administration, in the classroom, with their peers. So they're looking at all of those different things.
You know, we know how the Trump administration feels about this and how the right seems to hold this to a degree of credence. But what about the left? I mean, is this kind of a universally recognized metric, or do we think that this is quite partisan? Like, what do we know about the conversation surrounding those ethics?
Yeah, it's interesting because I had definitely thought of it as a quite conservative organization, and it is. But even though, like, the Trump administration basically, like, weaponizes it. But when I spoke to a few people at FIRE, they all said that they actually have told the Trump administration multiple times that they don't want FIRE to be used to penalize schools, and that they're, that the Trump administration is, like, using it incorrectly, and that those are the only conversations they've had with the Trump administration other than their some NIH lawsuit. However, clearly it is being used as a way to penalize schools, and it is being weaponized, and I don't think that the actual rankings does these schools that much good, because, you know, at the end of the day, like, there are schools that are down the list and they are having funding cut essentially because of that for the Trump administration. So it's definitely fraught at this point. However, just in terms of, like, taking a step back and thinking about free speech on campus, I have spoken to a lot of, I would say, you know, definitely Democratic professors at Yale who do think that free speech is a foundational part of Yale and of the college experience. And so the pendulum had swung too far towards people feeling like they couldn't speak their mind at school. There weren't those conversations anymore. And so I do think the school has been having a lot of conversations about how to make sure that all opinions are heard and that the classroom is a place where you don't feel uncomfortable speaking your mind.
We know that the Trump administration has been targeting elite institutions of higher learning in particular, Harvard and Columbia being the two examples that everyone's talking about these days. But Yale has really managed to avoid this for the reasons that we've discussed. But, you know, also it seems like he might have some friends there in the administration. Tell us about Yale's new president that everyone seems to be talking about.
Yeah, so Mari McGinnis, I wouldn't say that they're friends in any way, but she is, you know, the old president of Yale, President Salovey, who was also very well liked and respected, had spoken out about October 7th and basically avoided, I would say, that first round of controversy when Claudine Gay, for instance, had to step down at Harvard because she wouldn't come out against anti-Semitism. Like, he avoided that by creating the strong statement. Mari McGinnis came in before the Trump administration, and people describe her as this super nice, super friendly, blonde Southern woman who, she was at Stony Brook as the president last and had a very strong, stance on protests there. Was pretty hard on the protesters and also was able to shut it down in a way that didn't escalate the controversy. And so she has that reputation. She seems truly very well-liked on campus. And she spent a lot of her term so far, you know, she's been there for a year, in Washington, D.C. You know, Yale's put in way more money than it had last, you know, the second half of 2024 on lobbyists. And so it seems like there's been this massive effort from Yale to do what it can, at least to have good relationships in DC. And a lot of people, whether that is, you know, I spoke to some conservative students, whether that is Professor David Blight, who's a major historian, you know, the range of people all say, if we have to pick one reason why Yale has been able to so far avoid Trump's ire, it probably would be this new president.
But Claire, at the same time, I mean, you know, it's interesting, you know, Harvard, you've got Jared Kushner, who's an alum, right? You know, and none of the Harvard alums in the administration seem to be protecting that school. And yet, you know, when you look at in your reporting, who do you have as Yale alums? Clarence Thomas, Sam Alito, Brett Kavanaugh, J.D. Vance. It seems as though, I mean, they must have had pretty decent experiences that they're not turning on their school in the same way that maybe other people have. And you know, you've got big Republican mega donors have not withheld their gifts to Yale. So it seems like they've created, as you say, they've got a history of allowing free speech and being sort of balanced, and that's paying off, right?
Yeah, Yale, a lot of the students I spoke to, you know, students who are in the Buckley Institute, which is a conservative group on campus that really values free speech and is the one that will bring in like David Shapiro and Ben Carson. But
they even brought in Megyn Kelly.
Yeah, they brought in Megyn Kelly, and there really hasn't been a backlash on campus. The Yale Political Union, which again will host very lively debates on the full range of the political spectrum, is celebrating its 90th birthday. And so it feels very core to the way Yale operates, putting free speech and these kind of debates at the forefront. Meanwhile, for instance, the Harvard counterpart to that political union is only 15 years old. And when you speak to executives at FIRE or when you speak to professors, like the history of Yale is very steeped in free speech and healthy debate. And so I do think that has genuinely helped the university, that kind of ethos of accepting a really large range of opinions.
Maybe we'll see an honorary degree to Donald Trump in the next couple of years.
I don't know. I mean, there's this really hard balance, and it's one that is openly being talked about at the school among administrators and teachers about where's the line. President McGinnis adopted this policy of neutrality, of institutional neutrality, which means that she is deciding not to put out that many statements. I would also add that luck is a huge part of this. Like, I genuinely think that the mix of the Claudine Gay moment with the affirmative action case at Harvard was kind of also bad luck. And Yale, you know, whether it is its ethos, whether it's the people at its helm, whether it's something, you know, the alumni and its support in DC, you just also can't take for granted the fact that like it's had kind of good luck.
Well, thanks so much, Clara. Fascinating stuff.
Thank you.
I mean, Michael, like sometimes I forget that Trump himself is an Ivy League graduate. He went to the University of Pennsylvania, shocking though that might be for many of us. Why does he have such a chip on his shoulder with all these places? This is something for his psychologist to get into.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, it's maybe just, you know, another example of a billionaire behaving badly, shaking people down for money, which is kind of like leads us to Nantucket, more billionaires behaving badly.
Well, Michael, yes, that's why we love them for it. Bill Cohan is a writer at large at Airmail and the author of best-selling books, including my personal favorite, The Last Tycoons. His latest one is called Power Failure, and he's also a founding partner of Puck. Bill reports live from the island of Nantucket to tell us exactly who's behaving badly there this time. Welcome, Bill.
Hey, great to be here with you guys. Thank you for having me.
Well, Bill, thank you so much for reporting on the, I don't want to call it nonsense in Nantucket because obviously a lot of it is highly consequential, but for a tiny little island that is populated by more than its fair share of the world's billionaires, it certainly has a lot going on this summer.
Yeah, there's all sorts of interesting things going on as usual. Which one should we talk about, actually, since there are so many to choose from?
I mean, I'd love to get to the pressing matter of landscaping and view preservation. I mean, the whole notion of tree clearing is obviously a contested one on Nantucket, but there's one story in particular that has come to your attention this summer. Do tell us.
Yeah, this is, I mean, it seems like an epidemic of people wanting to, you know, go for the view. So they will have had no qualms about cutting down trees on the property that is not theirs, their neighbor's property, or doing so without permission from the proper authorities here. There are a lot of proper authorities here, as you can't really do much until you get their approval, but seems to be an epidemic of people cutting down the trees in order to get that better view. And one in particular this summer over on the other side of the island, John Jacoby allegedly went over to his neighbor's land, the Belfords, during the winter. Over the winter, they were not on the island. They were actually in a assisted living facility in Florida, and cut down, you know, like 16 trees in order to get that better view in a very random and haphazard way, leaving all sorts of ugly stumps. The Belfords claimed that this guy didn't have permission. He claims in his response to the ongoing lawsuit that he did have permission. And so, you know, that's where that battle stands. They've asked him for $1.4 million in restitution. He has also been criminally charged and faces criminal charges here in Nantucket for cutting down these trees. That case looks like it'll get underway in a month or so. So this is just sort of business as usual here. This is at least the third tree cutting incident in the last few years, you know, without permission or proper approval. So all in the name of trying to get a better view. This guy, John Jacoby, put his house on the market for $10 million, claiming that it had a view of the ocean, which, of course, it had probably only because he cut down the trees on his neighbor's yard without permission.
Bill, as you report, there's also, you know, evidence of food shortage on the island among one segment of the population, which is pretty rich, pun intended, given how incredibly wealthy the island is. I mean, it seems like of all the places in the U.S., you know, Nantucket along with the Hamptons are ones where this income inequality is really the most pronounced. What are you seeing there?
Yeah, another irony. So by some counts, Nantucket has about 75 billionaires on the island, mostly probably during the summer. And that's probably about 10% of the U.S. population of billionaires. So you sort of juxtapose that with the fact that some 21% of the year-round population, or about 3,000 people, have some form of food insecurity on an ongoing basis. And it sort of, you know, boggles the mind that this is possible, that this is happening. But, you know, sort of when you scratch below the surface and you realize how expensive housing is on the island, the lack of affordable housing, which is another big problem here, the fact that, you know, people who work here and live here year round basically have to make a year's worth of income in the 4 or so months of the summer when things are sort of blazing here, it creates, you know, a big problem where, you know, so much of their income has to go to housing. People, believe it or not, there's, you know, houses that go for as much as $45 million here. I think the average price of a home is, you know, close to $4 million. There are people who are sleeping in the state forest. There are people who are sleeping in their cars, people who are sleeping on the beach. You know, there are a lot of people who go hungry on a day-to-day basis. Something like 50% of the students in the public schools need food assistance on a daily basis. So that's the rough news. The good news is there's at least 12 organizations on the island who are committed to solving this problem. And they've just created sort of an umbrella organization called Nourish Nantucket that is hoping to create a $20 million endowment and raise $3 million a year, which, you know, obviously could be done very quickly if the right people on the island focus on this problem. It's starting to get a lot of attention from the media. They've actually done a pretty good job of highlighting this problem. As I said, there are organizations who are trying to solve it, but it you know, it remains an acute situation and therefore plenty ironic.
You focus on wealthy people, Wall Street, people with a lot of money. I can't help but be struck listening to your reporting this week. I mean, walking over your neighbor's house and cutting down lots of trees when they're not there. I mean, is this just another example of more money is more problems? Not for me, but for you. I mean, just the extreme wealth just gives these people license to think they can do whatever they want.
I mean, obviously, you know, it's hard to generalize.
Oh, please do. Please, go right ahead and generalize. I'm inviting you to.
Yes, I know. And I suffer, Michael, from billionaire adjacency syndrome, which is a rare and unfortunately chronic illness. I know some billionaires on the island. Some of the billionaires on the island are friends of mine, and they seem very nice and thoughtful and philanthropic. But I mean, there is a certain level of entitledness that comes here and quasi disregard for others. And I think, especially when it comes to real estate and, of course, enhancing the value of what you think will enhance the value of your property, Michael, you know, getting that ocean view can make things more valuable. And
I mean, Bill, it seems so easy to me. Like, why can't one of these billionaires swoop in and solve some of these big problems on the island? Like, what would it cost to, like, you know, feed the people who are starving? You know, like one of the $75 billion you made profiting off of, you know, earned by nefarious means or whatever. I mean, honestly, like, it just seems, can't someone cut a check for this? Like, can't anybody do that, you know, to help the people who are checking them out at the Stop and Shop on Nantucket, or, you know, making sure that their your housekeeper has enough food on the table. This stuff is nuts.
It's totally nuts, and it could be done very quickly, and it should be done because it's a symbiotic relationship that exists here. I mean, it's a beautiful island. These people have beautiful homes. You know, the people who maintain those homes for them year round, you know, some of them are suffering and struggling. So, you know, with basic issues like, you know, enough to eat. So it wouldn't take very much for them to write the checks. And I think, and they would barely notice it, of course. And I think, you know, I think the word needs to get out. Bruce Persolet, who is a Boston developer, who also owns N Magazine here and The Current, which are two publications, and is now chairman of the board of the hospital. What he realized is there were too many organizations and it was too diverse and too scattered. And so he's created this umbrella organization, and they've been really good, I've noticed, in recent months getting this message out. And he believes it can be solved pretty quickly. He raised $150 million for the hospital, which is a beautiful hospital. He said, you know, once Nantucket, people on Nantucket focus on a problem, they usually can solve it. The bigger problem, of course, is housing and affordable housing. And that is much more intractable problem that's much harder to solve. So maybe we solve getting people the food they need first, and then we can solve the housing problem.
Bill, I just want you to know that I've spoken with the hospital where they're on Nantucket, and they do have a special treatment facility for billionaire Jason syndrome.
I think what you do is you get an IV, Michael, because to solve the problem.
It's just it's a steady drip of money that just goes into you. That's what solves it.
I hope. Wouldn't that be nice?
Bill, thank you so much. Have a great rest of your summer.
Thank you, guys. Always a pleasure.
We have something here that everyone is going to love, which is a great way to decorate your living room. Haley Pepin, who is a London-based writer, takes us inside the trend that is sweeping Instagram and the coolest houses you know. Welcome, Haley.
Thanks for having me, guys.
So Haley, your story this week gives us a sense of hope and humanity. This idea that, you know, all of a sudden our socializing might be all about people and conversation instead of the distraction of screens. So take us inside the rise of the conversation pit as an interior design trend.
Yeah, so a conversation pit is a sunken lounge with built-in seating, and it's usually, you know, wrapped around maybe a coffee table or a fire. And because it's recessed below the floor level, it feels almost cocooned in a way and a little bit grounding, both in that physical and emotional sense, where I think when you're closer to the ground, you feel a bit more at ease as opposed to, you know, sitting upright and being quite sort of stiff. So it naturally invites people to gather and talk in conversation. So I think there's just been this real push where people are realizing, you know, how dependent they are on devices at the moment, and they're wanting to find a way to escape that and tap out. So they're seeing the conversation pit as this almost this den to really just, you know, put the phones, the laptops, you know, iPads aside, and really just, you know, gather together in a communal hug almost, I would say. It's very comfortable and cozy, and you can, you know, lay out like a starfish if you want to, or curl up like a cat in the corner. So it's very warm and inviting in that sense.
I always think of these as a 70s thing, but where did the trend begin?
So sunken gathering spaces have been around for centuries. So from Japanese homes to Roman banquets, but you know, the idea of the modern conversation pit really sort of emerged in the mid 20th century. And that's when, you know, entertaining at home was quite a glamorous affair. And, you know, there would be, you know, the Saturday night kind of hosting and all these visions of, you know, people listening to smooth jazz and, you know, women dressed to the nines and sequin dresses, sipping martinis, and, you know, cigarettes were lit and this whole vibe was created. So the most famous early version of this was the Miller House, and that was designed in 1958. And it was for a wealthy couple who, you know, loved hosting. The man of the house was an American industrialist, and his wife was quite the socialite. And Saarinen carved out this pit in a very vast living room to make it feel a bit more intimate. So they had quite a colossal open plan living space. And I think, you know, the middle was quite bare, and he tried to subdivide it by having this, you know, intentional pit to converse in. So anyway, the idea worked really well. And House and Garden, I believe, ran a 20-page spread on the conversation pit. And soon everyone from, you know, suburban homeowners to fashion designers like Holston really wanted to get a piece of the pit pie. And Holston summed it up really well, actually, to House Beautiful in 1977, where he said, you know, I work hard all day and I don't want to sit upright. I want to recline. So it's this idea of, you know, when you're sort of sitting upright, that sort of stiff formal seating arrangement around, you know, a dinner table, it can feel a little bit intimidating and confronting sometimes. So when you're sort of just, you know, spread out and lazing around, you feel more at home and at ease with, you know, conversing and, you know, having some of those deep and meaningful chats, or, you know, being a bit more playful in discussion. It doesn't have to be, you know, one or the other. So it's a really sort of nice idea to just be in the moment there.
Hayley, I have an important question.
Yes. What's that one?
So like here in New York City, I've been in some people's apartments where they have the sunken living room, right? Where you step down a stair or two from the entrance and you kind of go down, which helps you sort of, as you say, descend and like, but can you have a conversation pit without a sunken living room?
Totally, totally.
So I don't have to dig up my house and like excavate a floor down to get my conversation.
No. You don't have to get, you know, the full construction and level down and change the surfacing. No, I mean, I guess like you can create an intentional living space. And, you know, you can do that by throwing together different layered sofas, I'd say, and maybe a corner of the room and various pillows and throws, or, you know, you can buy a sectioned sofa and try and put it together. And it doesn't have to be something super expensive. It's just, you know, maybe having that L shape, or, you know, playing around with it. You know, if you want it to be, you know, a pit sort of design, maybe you can put it into that sort of square. And then if you want to, you know, tap out of that, you can sort of move it apart. So there are ways of doing it without having to invest a lot of money and commit to a project. And I think, you know, if you try and create that effect, it is easier to sort of, yeah, integrate and then change over time if you want to have a different space later on. So there are a multitude of design routes you can go with the conversation pit. And as I said, I think it's going to evolve further into sort of more intentional living spaces from here on out.
Hayley, I can't tell you how much I love this story. And I'm not only saying that as someone who has a shag rug in their living room. Thank you so much.
You're most welcome. I want to see the shag rug as well.
I will send you a picture of it. I also have a 1970s style lamp that is large and brown ceramic. Get excited.
Okay, I love that. We love some mid-century. And it's definitely a style that's going to be sticking around for a lot longer. Thank you.
Thanks, Hayley.
There's only one place to discover a global snapshot of the current cultural scene: AIRMEL's Arts Intel Report. Our international research tool for what to do and where and when to do it is user-friendly, continuously updated, and meticulously curated. Arts Intel is handy at home, on the road, and when you're planning your next trip. It also includes indispensable lists of restaurants and hotels in key cities around the world, recommended by our well-traveled experts. Explore Arts Intel at airmail.news/arts-intel, and be sure to sign up for our Week in Culture newsletter, which is published every Wednesday afternoon at airmail.news/WIC. I'm Chris Garrett, AIRMEL Deputy Editor, and I never leave home without it. Bon voyage.
Michael, like when you and I retired on Nantucket and we're just billionaires living our best billionaire lives, I think we should definitely get that dune sofa, build a custom conversation pit, and just enjoy the good life, gathering with our other fellow billionaires, solving the big problems of the world. Look at that.
I like it. I like it. I'm ready.
Well, it is the weekend. I know you have something you can recommend to me, please.
I do. And speaking of bad behavior and things we, you know, have a special affinity for here at AIRMEL, this one involves true crime. Have you happened to see any of The Twisted Tale of Amanda Knox?
Ooh, no, but I love the Amanda Knox story and followed it in the tabloids for years.
Yeah, many of you probably know it. It's on Hulu right now. And this centers on the true story of Amanda Knox. She was the 20-year-old American student who was wrongfully imprisoned in Italy for many years for the murder of her roommate. And this looks at the battle to prove her innocence and regain her freedom. And the show maps out not just Knox's long kind of journey from her arrest and from the murder to eventual exoneration for what turns out to be a wrongful conviction and 4 years in prison. But I mean, more than that, where it succeeds, I think, Ashley, is it sort of shows the miscarriage of justice that took place, but also how different forces combined to create this mess. The murder of her roommate, Meredith Kircher, is obviously horrible, but the series also captures, like I said, these failings of justice. And you know, the show also has gotten a lot of attention, because the executive producer is not just Knox, is one of them, but also Monica Lewinsky, someone else who knows about the justice system. But the real story, as I think is here, is Grace Van Patten, who plays Knox. She's amazing. Terrific performance. So I really encourage you to check it out. It's a good end of summer View, and it is called The Twisted Tale of Amanda Knox, and it's streaming right now on Hulu. So Ashley, what do you got for us?
I mean, I've got two completely opposite ends of the spectrum today in terms of my recommendations. But as you know, Michael, my son Charlie is completely mad for golf at the moment. And so when he was away at summer camp, he read the 2018 Tiger Woods biography. It's called Tiger Woods by Jeff Benedict and Armin Katan. Have you read this?
I remember reading an excerpt from it when it came out, but I have not gone cover to cover on it.
Well, needless to say, you know, golf is not necessarily the first place I go when I'm looking for entertainment. But because Charlie read it and then he was like, Mom, Tiger Woods had a sort of colorful personal life. I was like, uh-oh, here we go. So I read it. Yes, it did lead to a conversation in our house about sex addiction, but also it's like a really interesting, look, even if you know nothing about golf, which I do not, it's a fascinating portrait of a genius and it's really easy and fun to read. So for the sports lover in your life, I would say maybe 15 years of age or older, I highly recommend it. It's called Tiger Woods by Jeff Benedict and Armin Katayan. And then also, again, this is completely different, but one of my friends got me this book as a gift recently and I've been just devouring it in more ways than one. It's called The Bloomsbury Cookbook, Recipes for Life, Love, and Art. And the author is Jans Undaji Rolls, and it tells the story of the Bloomsbury group, but sort of through the lens of food. So it starts in the 1890s, and it ends actually much more recently than one might expect. But you know, this was such a creative renegade group of people, you know, E.M. Forster, Roger Fry, Virginia Woolf being among the most visible members. And the book not only has recipes of the things that they used to eat, but tales of how they socialized and enjoyed food. So it's a bit of a cultural history as well as a cookbook. And the recipes, I haven't, you know, made any of them yet. I promise to get to that. But I think it's just fun to read, even if you're not going to be cooking from it. And it's a great gift for your host or hostess if you are a house guest or a guest of any sort this summer season. So it's called The Bloomsbury Cookbook, Recipes for Life, Love, and Art by Jans Undaji Rolls.
Sounds great. I'm just wondering if you know, if they were doing an update to the Tiger Woods book, it would include his new relationship with Vanessa Trump.
Oh, God.
I don't know where that falls in on the relationship addiction spectrum, but I'll leave that for the sequel.
Oh God, honestly. Like in the last 8 years since that book is published, there's probably so much more that they could add to it. But you know, it has me working on my swing. What can I say, Michael? The next time you see me, I may be wearing a polo shirt and a very unflattering skort. All right. Well, we wish you all a marvelous weekend full of lots of good reading and plenty of distractions and hopefully no obnoxious billionaires. We'd like to thank our sponsor, Chanel. Michael, will you please read us out?
Yes, I just say four. Morning Meeting is produced by Airplay Productions and edited by Jesse Cannon. Our coders are Graydon Carter and Alexander Stanley. Our chief operating officer is Bill Keenan. Our deputies are Ashley Baker, Chris Garrett, Nathan King, Julie Vitale, and Ash Carter. Our CMO is Emily Davis, and our music supervisor is Randall Poster. Our theme music is The Cute Monster by the Buddy Collette Quintet. A new edition of AirMail is published every Saturday, so please subscribe and enjoy all of our stories on airmail.news, which we update every day. You can also find us on Twitter and Instagram at AirMail Weekly. We will be back here next Saturday with another edition of Morning Meeting, but in the meantime, be sure to subscribe at Spotify or Apple Music, but most of all, thanks again for joining us.